Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio. Good morning, everyone. It is the 6th of July. The sun is rising and the tomb is empty. And we say that each morning here on Faith Radio Mornings, as we start the show, as a reminder that we serve a king of a living kingdom that has no end. And hopefully what's true about that, among other things, is that as hard and confusing as life can get, Logan, there's always hope and there's always future in the beautiful kingdom of Jesus.
Peter, for something as exciting as what you're talking about, you don't start off so excitedly. You got to have more vigor to your welcome.
But you've got this like great radio voice, Logan. I mean, I've been in this chair for 18 days with you, and you're able to pull it out of me with that youthful vigor and energy. And you've got are you drinking Red Bull right now this morning?
It's Red Bull. There may be a secret sugar ingredient mixed into the Red Bull as well. Yeah. It's not.
Well, that is the voice of Logan Rao. She is ever capable on the sound and board. I am your interim host, Peter Kapsner, and we have also in the newsroom, Paul Perot, as well as Rachel Sutton, that have done a great job just booking these guests that are on this Faith Radio Morning show each day. And I just love, one of my favorite things about these 18 days being in this chair is the guest's ability to navigate these social conversations and political conversations and theological. I mean, it's complex. It's hard. It's one of the things that I have found, and I've said it often on the show, but it's also true of my own life, is the last 10-15 years, Logan, there's been a rise of anxiety. I think just generally speaking, right? We're sort of swimming in the waters of anxiety as a country. It's confusing. We don't really know what to do or where to turn, and our phones are kind of screaming at us all day long for attention. And so there's this sort of growing well of anxiety. And part of what I hope for in the show each day is it can feel like a Sabbath for all of us. It can feel like a place where we can sort of let down our hair. And in my case, that I don't have any hair, so that's not part of the deal. But that we can really just sort of come together as believers following Jesus and just take a pause in our spirit and to know that regardless of how confusing it is, there really is this place of rest that we can enter into.
And it's so stressful. It's so difficult to try and keep up with everything that's happening,
right?
Because at this point, with how much is happening and how fast, it almost has to be your full-time job just to stay informed and accurate. And luckily, we do have these incredible guests that it is their full-time job to stay informed and accurate, and they're so graceful. They're so graceful and gracious, and so good of heart to come on and help us walk through this in a Christian perspective. That, like you said, is a Sabbath. It's not just getting news. It's not just being updated about your day. It's being updated and being calm at the same time.
Yeah, one of those great guests that joins us every Friday morning is Karma LaBerge, who's the host of Connecting Faith, the midday show here on Faith Radio. And after the break, here in just a minute, she'll join us, and we'll start talking through those headlines from a perspective of faith. And we certainly do hope for all of you listening, it feels like a bit of a Sabbath to be part of the show. So good morning again. Welcome to Faith Radio Mornings. We'll take a break and we'll be back with Carmen LaBerge. That walk-up music just makes me happy when we hear it here on Friday mornings, because it means that we are being joined by Carmen LaBerge, the host of Connecting Faith midday show here on Faith Radio. And Carmen, I understand you're on vacation right now, and yet you're still joining us at this time. We really appreciate it. What are you up to? Where are you?
Well, good morning, Peter. I am in the mountains of Northeast Georgia, and we have a house full of teenagers this week. And so some of them are actually college age, but they range all the way down to about 10. And it's been so energizing and such a blessing. It gives me great hope for the future. They're on their way down here from Michigan and Ohio, they were listening. One car was listening to Eric Metaxas read Bonhoeffer, and the other was listening to Russell Moore's Onward. And so they were full of subject matter conversations last night, and it was just so... It's such a blessing, such a blessing.
So hang on. So you're with young people who are listening to Metaxas talk about Bonhoeffer.
Yes.
Is that what you just said? That is
crazy.
Incredible, Carmen. What was it? Just
yes.
Give us a short window into the conversation. What was it like?
Well, did I think that it was historically accurate? Did I think that he got these things right? Because this doesn't line up with what I thought I knew about such and such, or, you know. And so it just, I think it was, the thrilling part for me was how up to speed they were on the headline news of the day and how ready they were to genuinely bring, you know, their level of Christian worldview analysis to those conversations. They're very, each one of them is a, you know, very gospel-oriented kid. And one of these young men, his name's William, and he's headed off to Cedarville University this fall. He has done much of his growing up in Togo, West Africa, where his parents have been serving as missionaries. And, you know, he's just so, he's global, obviously, in the way that he thinks about Christianity. And he has this very tender heart. But, man, he's so sold out for Jesus. You're just like, I'm just so hopeful for the future.
I love that, Carmen, because I think, unfortunately, we get subject to too many generalizations in the headlines about a given generation, whether it's, you know, Generation X or Y or millennial generation. And so you actually spend time with people and it breaks it down. And just the fact that there's an awareness of the headlines, a sold out for Jesus relative to it, I think it's great. And why don't we get into the headlines? You know, that's what you're here to help us do and connect some of those headlines to faith. And one of them was, and I heard it on the radio yesterday, we were going out for dinner and my wife Hallie said, so Scott Pruitt, a cabinet member, resigned, and he was the head of the EPA. I don't know a lot about the situation other than I see the headlines of corruption. So what are you seeing in this, Carmen?
So Scott Pruitt, you know, I think from a Christian worldview, the conversation about this is probably got about 3 points. First of all, I think that in terms of bringing some necessary reining in some necessary overreach by the EPA, certainly during the Obama administration. Scott Pruitt did an admirable job. I believe he has accomplished some things that nobody else really would have had the backbone to accomplish. Now, having said that, he also has been doing some things as a employee of you and I, the taxpayers, that are clearly, and there are now 14 open federal corruption investigations into, you know, various and sundry things that he's been up to. So I think that from a Christian perspective, one of the things we need to say is our behavior always needs to be above reproach in order that we can actually do all the good that God has set before us in the world to do. I also think that people are going to hear in the news today that part of Scott Pruitt's resignation letter makes reference to Trump's election by the providence of God. And so when we have that kind of language, we as Christians need to be prepared to put that into context. We need to be prepared to say, you know, in reality, no one rises to leadership in any capacity in the world without God allowing it to happen. Now, did God, you know, ordain an individual to be president right now? And is that the person that's in the White House? I don't think those are questions that we are in a position to answer. Because we're the people living the history.
Yeah, it's such an important point, too, because we can too easily label a given situation as God ordained or a given leader or even one of our professional sports teams. I mean, we just need to think, you know, carefully about what it means that God might enable and allow, but that doesn't mean there's an ordaining moment of it. And boy, to your point, Carmen, just how important is leadership with character, right? I mean, doesn't that just ripple out with, create cynicism and skepticism among people when leaders aren't who they say they are?
Absolutely. I think that one of the ways that we talk about it in our house is, you know, if you're going to be a person who is advancing the gospel always and in all ways, then you need to be living as a gospel person. And so what does that look like? Because people are going to see and hear you long before they actually pay attention to the content of whatever it is that you're saying. And so your tone, the tone in which you say it is as important as the content. And certainly your own life needs to be a beautiful witness to the reality of who God is. So lordship of Christ in every area of life.
You know, another one of the headlines, obviously, that, and we've been talking about it quite a bit this week, but there continues to be new dimensions to it each day, it seems, is that the opening to the Supreme Court justice, to the bench there's a vacancy. And of course, President Trump is going to be announcing his nominee next Monday. But from what I saw, that list has been winnowed down from 25, then down to 7, then down to 5. And now it sounds like we're down to maybe 3 possible names for the Monday nomination.
Mm-hmm. So I think that Amy Barrett probably is the most interesting of the three to discuss. Brett Kavanaugh and Raymond Kethledge are actually very similar. They've both been on the federal bench for more than a decade. They're both originalists, textualists. They write their own opinions. There's a lot of paper trail there for people to look at. And I think that they would both be a lot like Neil Gorsuch. They both clerked for Justice Kennedy. Amy Barrett is a very different kind of candidate. She's actually brand new to the federal bench. She is a Trump appointee. And she was really openly attacked during her Senate confirmation hearing for her faith. She clerked for Antonin Scalia, and she's a professor at Notre Dame. She's probably the most interesting character in terms of a faith conversation and probably the one to watch. I think for Christians, the bigger conversation about this is, what is justice? What is a judge supposed to do? Like, it opens up conversations for us to have about who Jesus is as the judge in our conversations with others.
Well, and to your point with Justice Barrett, there was the quote that Dianne Feinstein, one of the senators, said that when she was going through her federal nomination hearing, she said that your dogma lives loudly within you. And it was sort of this derisive comment that the senator made, that Barrett maybe wears too much of her faith on her sleeve, is at least the critique at this point. And so it is a very interesting potential choice here relative to her background in faith, right? I mean, this could play itself out pretty substantially.
Absolutely. I think that the question of whether or not what we believe, characterized here as dogma, whether or not what we believe actually influences how we behave, and in this case, how we judge. And I would certainly hope that it does. I would hope that, a person who is a Christian, who is on the federal bench, would be judging with the wisdom of God. That would be my prayer. I mean, that's who Solomon was. I mean, we forget that to be a judge, to sit in judgment over other people, requires a wisdom that goes beyond just intellectualism. And so that would be my hope, is that we would end up with justices who judge by wisdom and not simply by, some sort of political or even intellectual commitment.
That's great. This is Carmen LeBurge, the host of Connecting Faith. Carmen, we'll take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about the Supreme Court justice situation and what it means to have wisdom in terms of the impact that the decisions in the present make for the future and what they have. I'd also love to get into the changes coming to the Book of Common Prayer among Episcopalians and gender-neutral language. So need your help walking through it, Carmen. So grateful you're here. This is Faith Radio Mornings. I'm Peter Kapsner. We'll be back in just a minute. It is 20 minutes past the hour, and we are joined on the line by Carmen LeBurge, who on vacation still gracious enough to join us and talk through some of the headlines of the day that we wake up to. And Carmen, you said some really interesting things about the need for wisdom among the Supreme Court justices, but that's true of all of us in all of life, right? I mean, wisdom, from my understanding in the biblical text, is not just the ability to make a decision in the moment, but to be able to see how that decision is going to ripple out into the future. And of course, the decisions of the Supreme Court justices over the years have continued to ripple out. But that's true of all of our lives, right? That we need this discernment. We need this wisdom to know what to do in the present relative to the future.
Absolutely. So I think that wisdom is probably a word that Christians would do well to reclaim in the contemporary conversation. It's not a word that, sort of is overused, and therefore it's not worn out. It's certainly not a word that that the left has laid much claim to. And so I do think that spending some time in the wisdom literature of the Bible, spending some time, obviously, in the Spirit of God, who is the one who opens the Word to us in ways that we can then understand and apprehend what God has said and how what God has already said speaks into life today. I think that all of that, Peter, is really essential for Christians seeking to live today, as authentic followers of Jesus Christ, because the world is full of a lot of information that has nothing to do with the wisdom of God. And when we talk about, looking for a Supreme Court justice who is an originalist or a textualist, the other conversation for Christians to be having here is that there's a parallel experience going on in the culture and in the church. In mainline liberal denominations, there's the attempt to revise, revisit, rewrite what the Bible says, as if the author of it didn't know what he was doing or didn't have an intent when he communicated it. And there's a parallel there with the way that revisionists approach the Constitution of the United States. They're obviously not, the Constitution is not an inspired document in the same way that the Bible is, but the interpretation of the Constitution when placed in the hands of a textualist or an originalist, as a person who's going to actually take the original author's intent under consideration. It's not it's not considered a living document by originalists or textualists. So that's another conversation that Christians can have this week as the culture is talking about Supreme Court nominees.
That's great stuff. And it's so true, because I think we can masquerade our sense of wisdom as like what we want out of a text, as opposed to trying to understand the text on its own terms and then bending the arc of our life towards that. Right. I mean, we can misunderstand the Bible.
Absolutely.
When we try to read into it what we want to see what's there, as opposed to allowing it to speak to us in a different kind of way.
Our powers of rationalization are very well developed.
I know mine are, for sure. There's a big part of my brain that is a little rationalized just about anything. Well, there's another headline you sent me, and that was maybe we can end our segment with today, and that was this change that Episcopalians are proposing to the Book of Common Prayer that would move it towards more of a gender-neutral set of terminology. First of all, just tell us what the Book of Common Prayer is, and then the implications for moving towards more of a gender-neutral situation.
So when we use the term Episcopal Church here in the United States of America, we're actually now talking about a discrete and fairly small denomination. We're no longer talking about the only form of Anglicanism in the United States. So the Episcopal Church is the one we're talking about. We're not talking about global Anglicanism. We're not talking about the Church of England. And we're not talking about, if you know some evangelical Anglicans in your community, we're not talking about them either. We're talking about a liberal mainline denomination called the Episcopal Church. They are meeting right now in one of their big national meetings. And the proposal, one of the proposals is to make changes to the Book of Common Prayer. Now, the Book of Common Prayer is a book that dates back to 1549 and is used globally by Anglicans. So first of all, it is... It is arrogant for the Episcopal Church in the United States of America to think about amending or changing a book that's used globally by Anglicans with whom they would have huge disagreements about the matters that they're considering. And those considerations, the things that they're talking about, is changing all of the language that is that would refer to God in any male form. So the word father would be expunged. Male pronouns would be expunged. Any reference to God as male would be removed. So there's a neutralizing or a neutering of the language in relationship to God. Even, as you might imagine, the Book of Common Prayer includes the Lord's Prayer. It's hard to imagine how you're going to expunge a direct, it's Jesus who said, pray this way, our Father. So I don't know how you change the words of Jesus in the Book of Common Prayer. The other thing that I think would be interesting for people to know, first of all, I don't think these changes would come for decades. We're probably talking about 2030 before they would actually get around to printing a new Book of Common Prayer for Episcopalians here in the United States. So there's not an urgency in terms of it actually happening, but there is an urgency in terms of how people in our culture are affirming of the self-identification of any individual in any way they want to be referred to. And so, people are allowed to say what their preferred pronouns are and change their name if they want to. But God's not allowed to say how he wants to be addressed. Hmm. God's not allowed to declare his own. He's not allowed to self-determine what pronouns would be used in reference to him. It's the height of hubris, I think, for Episcopalians to be talking about this kind of change at this point in history.
Great stuff, Carmen. We just have 30 seconds left. Give us a little preview. What are you working on for Connecting Faith today?
Hey, we're going to talk to Joshua Straub about a book called Safe House, and it's about emotional safety in your home, like how to actually raise your kids in an environment where they're emotionally safe, and from there, then they can really develop into the people that God intends for them to be.
That's great stuff. Carmen, enjoy your vacation. Thanks again for joining us. Kick off the day here on Faith Radio Mornings, walking through the headlines. Enjoy the rest of your time.
Thanks, Peter.
It will take a short break. It is 27 minutes past the hour. We'll head to Lighten Up and a break for news and then into the second half of our first hour together. It's Faith Radio Mornings, and I'm Peter Kapsner. Logan, I love starting out the show like that, as we said, with Carmen. It's just, and when we talk about the sense of sort of peacefulness and Sabbath, I mean, these are tricky things that she was talking about when you're talking about changing the historical language of the Book of Common Prayer, as well as the resignation of a cabinet member. There's a lot of stuff, so I appreciate her coming on and kind of just talking through these headlines in the way she does.
Oh, she's brilliant. And I feel like I know that what I'm getting from her is just what I want to hear anyway. I mean, I just get to sit back and just let knowledge pour in.
Hey, one part of news we'll have to address a little later, but I was super excited about this headline before the real headlines of the day, right? Is that a South Dakota tractor was taken by a tornado and it was later found in Montana. I cannot wait to get into the story later. I have no idea what's going on here, but we'll head into that part of the story and maybe some actual news here coming up in just a minute. Jed Medefin, the president of the Christian Alliance for Orphans, is talking to us about the idea that we can all do something in these difficult situations. It really is possible for us to care for the orphans around us.
A child that's just getting food and shelter without the love and nurture of a family, the statistics show that they do not do well over the long run. What every child really most needs is love and belonging. And so we see that in the U.S., but then overseas as well. There's such pressing physical need in many countries. The effect of HIV/AIDS has ripped apart the social safety net in many countries, and so there's a desperate need there as well. And so, you know, what I just encourage people is I say, hey, you know, not every Christian is called to adopt, not every Christian is called to foster. There's certainly great need in those realms, but every Christian can play a role, and that can look like supporting families in your church that are fostering or adopting, being a surrogate grandparent, or running errands, or helping with yard care, or being a mentor. There's a role called the CASA, court-appointed special advocate, and you essentially become a mentor and speak up for this child in court and in other cases. And then there's, of course, plenty to do in terms of financially supporting work around the world as well. So, you know, it's an all of the above, and it's just a saying, hey, Lord, I want to be a part of your response to these kids. How do you want to use me?
That's Jed Medefin, the president of the Christian Alliance for Orphans. If you want to catch that entire segment, head to myfaithradio.com. You can search for orphans or for Jed or for president of Christian Alliance, something like that. It undoubtedly will get you there. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, I had a chance to talk with Owen Strand the other day, who is a professor of Christian theology. And there's a conference coming up in St. Louis called the Revoice Conference that is supporting and encouraging and empowering gay, lesbian, and same-sex attracted people to they can flourish while observing the historic doctrine of sexuality. And Owen did a great job talking us through what's good about that conference, what might be difficult. You're not going to want to miss this interview with Dr. Strand.
When biblical values are under attack, how should we respond? This is Jim Garlow. People who take the Bible seriously know that when scriptural principles are followed in society, good things happen. After all, it was God who thought of the idea of people, communities, nations. But how will we see culture transform? Our communities become better places. Our nation live up to its potential. Many of us fall into two categories. One, we engage the culture, that is, we're relevant to it, but instead of transcending it, we compromise to worldly values. Or we transcend culture, that is, we don't compromise, but we fail to engage it, to have meaningful conversation with people who are different from us. The secret is to engage yet transcend the culture, to be relevant to the unbelieving culture around us, to connect to this world but not embrace its values. There's more on this at jimgarlow.com.
Good morning. You're listening to Faith Radio Mornings. I'm Dr. Peter Kapsner, and we are joined on the line now by Dr. Owen Strand of Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. You're Associate Professor of Christian Theology there. Is that correct, Owen?
That is correct, Peter. Thanks for having me.
It was so timely. I know there's a conference coming up called the Revoice Conference, and it's going to focus a lot on some of the gender issues that are really pretty constant in the headlines these days in our country, specifically the LGBT community. And some of the main questions, I don't know about you, but I see in my classes, is how do we as a church respond to this conversation? What does it mean to be living in communities of faith together with people in the LGBT lifestyle? How do we navigate all of this? So I would love for you, Owen, to start by kind of educating our listeners about what's happening at the Revoice Conference, and then we'll talk about some things that maybe are problematic relative to it.
Sure. Well, Revoice is being held in St. Louis in July 2018, and it's a conference that is aimed at promoting what we could call gay Christianity. And gay Christianity is basically this view that that sees us as able to merge our Christian identity with a gay identity. Now, the people at Revoice, thankfully, are not those who are going to argue that you can engage in homosexual acts or behavior as a Christian. That's not the standpoint of anyone I'm aware of who's speaking at Revoice. So that's a good thing to note. On the other hand, there are some folks there who are going to argue that you can definitely have a bisexual identity, an LGBT identity, a gay or lesbian identity, and still be a faithful Christian. So there are a number of presentations at the conference surrounding that kind of material, and that's kicked up a bunch of response.
And it sounds like what's really at stake is there is this affirmation that maybe you were even created by God in some way relative to your identity. And if you have been almost given a gay or a bisexual identity, that then from there, what the call is to stay celibate, to not practice that part of your life. So it's almost a little bit of a confusing message that maybe you have an identity of some kind, but you're not allowed to walk out that identity. Is that some of what's happening here?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think Revoice is kind of a confusing conference, frankly, because there are a wide number of presenters at it who hold some different views. But yes, if we really boil it down, one of the core contentions of the leaders of the conference is that you can retain a gay identity as a Christian. A gay identity does not necessarily pertain to your sexual patterns of attraction. It's something that's almost pre-sexual, according to some, Wesley Hill and others. And so that kind of contention is sitting ill at ease for some of us, because we would go to a text like 1 Corinthians 6:9-11, and we'd want to interrogate whether or not we can hold any identity, forget homosexuality, Peter, any identity that is not Christian as a believer. Of course, we all are going to struggle against sin in this life. That is absolutely going to be the conviction of someone like me, and praise God for people who want to struggle against any pattern of attraction, any sexual inclination that is not right to express in practical behavior. But the question is, the question that's really swirling on the blogs right now, and it's a major debate, is whether we can retain a gay identity, a homosexual identity as a Christian, and still be a faithful believer. Does that honor the New Testament and the apostolic teaching? And that's being debated now.
And I really want to dig in with you about what our core identity is, and you referenced some passages of Scripture, so I'd love to do that in just a minute. But before going there, I think, is it a fair analogy to suggest, for me growing up in the church, things like pornography were so pervasive, and it was just sort of assumed that men, for example, in this scenario, were going to be attracted to pornographic images. That wasn't even a question. It was then just what you would do with it from there. And there almost got to be identity statements, and I've seen them in Christian literature, that men are at their identity sexual hunters. That's not the question. The only question is whether they'll act on it. And now, again, we're living in this kind of weird disconnect, right, of this idea that the identity maybe isn't actually, you're having an experience, sure, but the experience doesn't mean that that's your identity. And in this case, sexual hunting is not necessarily the identity of the male.
Yeah, we have to handle with care on these matters, because we want to be very clear that if we're going to the Bible, God has wired men. We're talking about in a fundamental general way, according to his creational design, he has wired men to want a woman in order that marriage would happen. And we want to make clear that that God's plan for marriage is a beautiful and good thing. It's the norm, honestly, for us. We also need to make clear a second truth, I think, today, and that is that because of the fall, because of the real historical fall of Genesis 3, Our desires do not necessarily run every which way as they are supposed to, according to the design of God for the glory of God. Every single one of us, whether we, you know, look cookie cutter marriage material or we don't, every single one of us has desires coursing through our blood because of inherent depravity that are not going to glorify God. And so I think the first part of what you and I were just saying is what Christians have more understood, God's creational design, that it is a beautiful thing for a man and a woman to come together in marriage, that God wants that, that most people are called to that vision, and we want to keep championing that. We also have to make very clear, though, that we're all going to struggle with wrong desires in our heart. After becoming a Christian, we're going to have these times when our identity wavers and we don't feel like we know who we are. And I'm not always sure that Christians have had this kind of nuanced discussion, which really isn't some kind of, you know, super technical theological matter. It's just a matter of understanding Genesis 3 and understanding how we have desires that run contrary to God's design. So bringing those two matters together, I think, today will help us both continue to celebrate God's design for covenantal marriage, which, of course, is crystallized in the relationship of Christ and his church, Ephesians 5, but also equip us to provide counsel and strengthening and love to Christians who have desires not running necessarily towards marriage as God designed it, but want to live faithfully for Christ. We can do both of those things, celebrate marriage and help others who don't necessarily find themselves in marriage.
It's great. We're talking to Dr. Owen Strand about matters within the LGBT community and even some of these identity statements that really are part of our ongoing cultural language that we have. So we'll take a short break and come back, and we'll ask about a different kind of possibility besides just getting either a gay or a straight identity. Be right back with you. Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings. I'm Dr. Peter Kapsner, and joined at this time by Dr. Owen Strand, and we are exploring matters of LGBT identity statements that are being made, specifically in relation to this Revoice conference that is coming up in St. Louis, in which the claim being made is that you can have a great gay Christian identity, and as long as you stay celibate in your lifestyle, you're sort of fulfilling the call of our faith. And Dr. Strand, you've written an article that suggests that this disconnect between practice and identity maybe isn't a viable option. Can you say more about an alternative that we can think about with this?
Yeah, we have to go to the Bible to handle these matters. And that's one of the most important things to say in this whole conversation is a lot of people are very confused. They have language, you know, from the secular academy about orientation and all these sorts of matters. And they're really confused about how to think through how they engage these kind of issues, gay Christianity and the Revoice Conference. What we need to do is we need to just go back to the inerrant and all-sufficient word. We think of a text like 1 Corinthians 6, 9 through 11. We recognize that Paul in this text is speaking to a Corinthian people who are essentially in the den of iniquity of that time, of the first century era. To Corinthianize somebody in the first century meant to basically make them an object of scandal, to baptize them in depravity, essentially sexual depravity especially. And so what Paul is doing is so important for us in 1 Corinthians 6. He's saying to his audience, a number of whom have really indulged the lust of their flesh, and he's telling them, you used to be fornicators, idolaters, adulterers, effeminate people, homosexuals, thieves, covetous folks, drunkards, and so on. But you are no longer, verse 11, 1 Corinthians 6, 11, such were some of you, but you were washed, you were sanctified, you were justified in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ and in the Spirit of our God. We desperately need those words today, Peter, because what Paul does not do there is say, you guys used to do some of these behaviors, but now you don't do those actions anymore. That's implied in what he says. What he actually says is, you used to have these identities. Your behavior, in other words, shaped your identity, but now you're not that anymore. You don't have that identity any longer. As he's going to say elsewhere in his writings, you're a new creation, 2 Corinthians 5:17, Romans 6:6, we've died to our sins such that it's been crucified with Christ. We have a new name. We're a new creature. We're a new man in Jesus Christ. So we have to understand as believers, yes, we're going to battle against the flesh till the day we die. The Spirit's going to help us with that. We're going to be progressively, we say, sanctified in theological circles to sum up biblical teaching. But we also have to make clear, if we don't get this, that our identity is in Christ, and we're not a merger of 50% Christian, 50% devil. We are now born again. We are a new creation. And I fear, Peter, today that the church is losing sight of this teaching.
Well, and it has potentially pretty significant implications. And I would love for you to comment. I know, you know, for people in my own life and friends that I have and in my classrooms and students, when they talk about this subject, the question comes up, you know, can these desires shift and these attractions shift over time? And that's a pretty... it's a very vulnerable conversation to have. It takes a lot of thinking around it. And I think one of my fears is that people would say, well, if you just pray about it, your desires and your attractions will change. Just give it 24 hours. It's like God's this genie in a bottle and you get a couple wishes, right? I mean, can you speak, if this isn't an identity statement, how do we navigate the desires and can those desires shift over time?
That is such an important matter. And I agree with you. I do think that in some cases in the past, the church has failed to offer helpful counsel on this matter. And by the way, not just this matter, other matters as well. Yep. You know, if you're caught out in a sin, you just sort of have a real, you know, it was used to be called a come to Jesus meeting or something like this. And you just kind of sort it out and it's never going to happen again. And we'd love to say that would happen. And it, let's be honest, for some people in the moment of repentance, when they realize this really is a dishonoring desire, a sinful desire that they're having for homosexual activity in their heart, whether they play that out in practice or not, even the desire itself is not godly, that can be a moment of eradication. We don't want to say that's never possible. The testimony of some folks who experience same-sex attraction and most any other pattern of sinful desire is that you can have God give you immense victory in the moment or immense victory over time, and it never lures its head again. But for a lot of people, for all of us, in some form, there are going to be temptations we face and sins we fight for a lifetime. So we don't know how God, in his mysterious providence, is going to bless us through his Spirit to kill sin in us. We know we have to kill sin, Colossians 3, 1 through 11. So we got to do that. But we don't know what that's going to look like. For some people, that may mean this fight for holiness, for godliness, powered by divine grace through the cross of Jesus Christ. This may mean that these temptations ebb. It may mean that they end up getting married to a member of the opposite sex and glorifying God through marriage and child raising. That may really happen. You think of a woman like Rosaria Butterfield, for example, or Jackie Hill Perry as two examples of lesbians who never would have thought that they would be married with children, you know, to in a heterosexual marriage, but now are. Rosaria Butterfield has four children. Other folks are going to find themselves not necessarily desiring marriage, not desiring the opposite sex in any honorable way, and so they're not going to be married. And we have to make space in our churches for both types and everyone in between. Really, Peter.
I think that's such an important point. And we just have only about a minute left, unfortunately, but that's what I'd love to finish with is just the importance that there isn't this exclusionary thing. Like, they're holding the tension between exclusion and embrace, right? That we're walking out this journey together and we'll just see what God is up to in our lives together as people of faith.
Yeah, we need to be really clear that all of this work to get our identity right and to understand sinful desire right is not like the bad part of Christianity. This is the loving part of Christianity. We don't want to stay in our flesh. We want to watch as God in his grace transforms us and gives us new desires. For some believers, that's going to mean a radical shift in life. For other believers, it's going to mean a daily death to self on this particular matter. It's going to mean, you know, just taking up your cross daily and repenting of any known sin and fighting the flesh. So that's in truth, though, what all of us must do. So anytime someone puts their arm around us in the local church in particular or at a school like yours or mine and helps us walk faithfully, that is love. Killing sin, pointing one another to Christ is love.
That's great stuff. Dr. Strand, thank you so much for joining us. I would love to have you back in the program after the conference to just kind of revisit what all emerges from it. So thank you for your time this morning. We'll take a short break. Stay with us. We'll be back in a minute.
I love that conversation with Owen Strand that we had a chance to have. These are obviously such difficult issues. We had Jim Bilby on yesterday's program. He's a professor of theology at Bethel University, and he's writing a book about different views of transgenderism and just this whole gender conversation. And Logan, you know, it's not going to be any one conversation that is the silver bullet and we figure out all this stuff. I mean, this tsunami of gender conversation swept over us about 5-6 years ago, and we're kind of still living, I think all of us, in so much of the rubble. Like, how do we understand our lives moving forward? So to take the chance to open up the box a little bit in a variety of ways in this conversation just feels like, can we make some headway? Can we start figuring out? It's the call of people of faith in any generation, right? To think about what is life in the kingdom relative to the circumstances around us. How do we walk this out? So I appreciate him coming on and doing some of this with us.
Oh, and that conversation is so important to be had because something is changing every day. I mean, the transgender conversation especially, most of the transgender community aren't even on one page about what it means and what everyone identifies with, etc. So the fact that they haven't even figured out means we have to get started somewhere or we're going to be left behind and still working on this in 50 years.
Yeah, I think one of those sort of rocks in which we can stand is the idea that to be careful to not have our identity be located in an experience in life in some level, whether, I enjoy football, suddenly I have an identity as a sports fan, which we're making these identity statements all day long. And for people experiencing attractions, whether they're attractions towards a screen that's inappropriately in pornography or attractions the same gender, those are real. We're not going to deny that our attractions are real, whatever they might be. But to then to create the identity statement out of them, maybe it's more helpful to think, hey, we're sons and daughters of the King, us all. We're made in God's image. We might be having experiences in life, but to then make an identity statement is dicey.
We want so badly to fit in and be a part of a group, but we can't form our identity in what we do. I'll never identify as a power lifter. It'll just never happen. I can't do it.
Great stuff. I appreciate the first hour with the guest. We'll take a short break and come back with Adam Holtz and talk about movies in Hollywood.
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.